Shakespeare's late works are characterized by a central preoccupation, a preoccupation that shapes his narratives, that shapes his poetic language, shapes perhaps his whole artistic vision: to set onto the stage the drama of forgiveness. Shakespeare uses and reuses the theatre to play out scenarios that explore this most delicate of questions. How is forgiveness born in the human soul? How can its action be depicted onto the stage? How does forgiveness resolve the most seemingly difficult and convoluted of philosophical or ethical or religious dilemmas? And to explore these questions, Shakespeare unashamedly makes use of a host of magical theatrical devices. Statues, as you know, come to life. We've got spirits making heavenly music out of thin air. Natural elements are commanded by magicians. Children miraculously survive catastrophes, and many characters come back from the dead to resolve conflicts and shine light upon past deeds. In all of these scenarios, and perhaps because of his unashamed use of magical theatre, forgiveness in Shakespeare tends to appear as something dazzlingly superhuman, and yet also somehow strikes us as the one truly human deed. So I want to suggest that Shakespeare's use of magical devices to resolve otherwise seemingly unresolvable situations on the stage is not a cop-out way of sorting out tricky dramatic situations, as Lytton Strachey famously suggested, but I want to suggest that it's in fact a vital, vital component of Shakespeare's realism. Instead of assuming that magical theatre ventures into the escapist, the unrealistic, or simply obeys the overblown conventions of romance theatre, I want to play with the opposite approach. That the world Shakespeare depicts onto the stage, a world in flux between a natural and a more than natural plane, where the actions of humans are often prompted by more than human forces, characters, or situations, is, for Shakespeare, the mirror held up to nature. It is the world of a dramatist who profoundly, yet delicately, explores the human condition and the relationship between humanity and non-human things. So, from that, I also want to suggest that forgiveness in Shakespeare is never the product of human reason alone, in the sense of a mere mental decision, a mental act consciously, willfully assented to by a moral agent, like obedience to duty or to an external moral law. But all the same, forgiveness is not simply performed on the character's behalf by mere reversals of fortune or otherly powers either. The acts of forgiveness of Imogen in Cymbeline, or Hermione in A Winter's Tale, or Prospero in The Tempest do sound a truly human note despite occurring in this context of magical drama. So the real for Shakespeare, by which I mean the reality that he sets forth onto the stage, incorporates what is human and what is more than human. And these two are intermingled, participate in one another. Our sense of what is real, in the sense of what is rationally perhaps possible in an everyday sense, is intertwined with a more than human yet not otherworldly dimension. A different realm that is also involved in a perhaps not clearly or easily classifiable way, but involved nonetheless in the whole of reality. So to uncover this, we need to think a little bit about Shakespeare's poetics, or what I'm suggesting, a part of Shakespeare's poetics. And to do this, I will qualify this more than human realm borrowing the vocabulary and some features from A Midsummer's Dream, and terming this more than human realm for the time being the imaginative realm, or the realm of the imagination. So, what I'm calling playfully a two-tiered reality with its imaginative dimension, and I mean playfully in the sense of I'm not going to suggest to you that Shakespeare is a hard-nosed metaphysician or a theologian. I think that, because otherwise that would, we would have to assume that art and theatre are somehow a secondary category and are merely a vehicle to explore fundamental, more fundamental metaphysical or theological ideas. I'm saying instead that Shakespeare explores things playfully, delicately, yet seriously. I'm reminded of an African saying, which I heard from Peter Brook, who's perhaps one of the 20th century's most eminent Shakespearean, and it is, if you're too serious, you're not serious enough. And I think that that sort of sense of serious playfulness is very, very present in Shakespeare. I think he touches on very profound things delicately, and it's important to remember that delightful balance between the serious and the playful as we explore his works. So I'm using this word imagination, which is of course a word that appears in A Midsummer Night's Dream, but not perhaps in a romantic sense, in the sense of something, a special kind of insight in the sense of that Blake or Coleridge might mean it. But I mean simply that something is made into an image, much like a play on a stage. Perhaps even using Philip Sidney's phrase, though somewhat out of context, a speaking picture. A play is a speaking picture. But it's a speaking picture that doesn't just speak in a vacuum. It addresses us. Plays address us. And an address requires a response. So it's a speaking picture that is also somehow spoken to. So theatre in this sense, a speaking picture. And the reality that Shakespeare depicts onto the stage then speaks, that is, addresses not just the audience, but also the characters, and requires a response. I think if we remember, I mean, anyone who's seen a Shakespeare play remembers the many soliloquies in which we're told so clearly how characters respond to the challenges that reality are throwing at them left, right, and center. There's not much subtext in Shakespeare. Everything seems to be said, which I think is rather wonderful. And yet, he says so many things, but he never crowds us with too many things. There's always more to think about and more to learn. So we're thinking about A Midsummer Night's Dream for a moment, just to get into this sense of the two-tiered reality. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, we have the intervention of the moonlit dream world, the world of the imagination. And the intervention of that world is essential for the success of what happens in the day world, the world of human reason, the Athens. What's interesting in that play is that the Athenians begin by taking everything literally. So you've got a literalistic society. From Theseus, I hope you remember the play, by the way. I'm going to skip around a little bit, but hopefully it will all make sense as I speak. From Theseus, the Duke of Athens, who is bound by Aegeus's malicious and literalistic understanding of the Athenian law. So if you remember, the conflict at the beginning of that play is Aegeus, the senior Athenian sort of statesman slash village elder, who says, well, hang on, you know, I've got my daughter Hermia. I say she has to marry that guy Demetrius. She's in love with that guy Lysander. They're both just as good as each other. But what I say goes, and Theseus, you can't do anything about it because this is our law. And Theseus is bound by that. So the spirit of the law is ignored. But as usual in Shakespeare, what happens at one level resonates at another level. And if you remember, we've got the mechanicals, who also have their own sort of literalistic problems. And as they're putting on the play, as they're rehearsing the play that they're going to perform for Theseus's wedding day at night, they have a constant distrust of what theatre does, to the point that they constantly have to remind themselves to tell the audience that a man, an actor playing a lion, is not really a lion. Or a man holding a lantern and a thorn bush and a dog is really the man in the moon. So just as the aristocrats of Athens are imprisoned by the letter of the law, the working people are confounded by the kinds of things that imaginative narratives are. They break them down in favor of a crude reductionist empiricism. So the world of Athens shows at the beginning of the play a distrust of its counterpart, the moonlit world of the imagination, the wood outside. And it's only through the many adventures outside of Athens and the many dealings of fairies with the humans that the reason world of Athens becomes, by the end of the play, even though that world, somehow the Athenians remain unaware of everything that's going on, but somehow that world is changed by its dealings with the world of the imagination. It's made translucent with the possibilities offered by the imaginative dimension of the real. So, for example, at the end of the play, Theseus, the Duke of Athens, even though he rails against the imaginations and thinks that the poets are all, you know, confused, but nonetheless he understands that imagination can amend what is lacking in his world. For example, by receiving the Mechanicos play with grace, in the spirit with which it was intended. A little side note here, which is going to be important for us, is that the lovers, the aristocrats, as they witness this catastrophic play, are constantly commenting. And I think those little comments, those little witty comments and discussions, are not just there to make us laugh and to make the aristocrats appear a little bit ridiculous, although certainly that is there, that dimension is always there, because we're still in a playful world. But I think Shakespeare wants us to hear how those characters respond to the play performed in front of them, right? Shakespeare uses this device of the metatheatre all the time, and the response of the characters is ever so important, and this is one such instance. So, we've got this transformation of a literal society into, by the end, a kind of poetic society where art and love triumph. And it is affected because of this mingling of the day world with the night world, the reason world with the imagination world. So let's look at some features of this imaginative world. And the first feature that I want to think about for a second is the importance of narrative, of telling story, and of remembering the right story. But what's interesting about the dwellers of the dream world, the fairies, is that they speak primarily to each other and to themselves, to us, to the audience, in songs and narratives. They tell us who they are by telling us the story of who they are. Somehow their myth is their being. And if we can turn to our first little extract in the handout, I do hope you can read it. I realize it's a very small print. But I'll read it out in my legendary Shakespearean performance. So this comes from Act 2, Scene 1, and this is the moment where Puck first appears on the stage, and he encounters this fairy who belongs to Titania's train of fairies. And as the exchange grows, the fairy starts to recognize Puck. She starts to recognize him, and she says to him, "Either I mistake your shape and making quite, or else you are that shrewd and knavish sprite called Robin Goodfellow. Are not you he that frights the maidens of the villagery, skim milk, and sometimes labour in the quern, and bootless make the breathless housewife churn, and sometime make the drink to bear no balm, mislead night wanderers, laughing at their harm? Those that hobgoblin call you and sweet Puck, you do their work, and they shall have good luck. Are not you he?" So this lovely repetition of the "are not you he" question is really saying, is this not your story? But at the same time, that story is what you are, who you are. So you've got these dwellers of the imagination world that speak about each other and to each other in terms of narratives. And likewise, we've got the big quarrel between Oberon and Titania soon after. And they tell us the story of their quarrel by placing it in a huge mythic and cosmic context. I don't have that because that's, you know, 17 pages long, but hopefully you can remember a little bit of it. The quarrel is not really a quarrel until the full story of the quarrel has been told. But I do have the story of the love flower here, just a little extract of that. And if you do remember, Oberon decides to sort out the problems of the humans by using this this love potion that comes from the flower that Cupid, while he was aiming at somebody who might have been Queen Elizabeth, misses. And the flower and the arrow, the dart, touches on the flower. And so somehow with the juice of that flower, you can somehow set everything to right. I mean, some kind of crazy convoluted thing that only happens in the world of fairies, as I'm sure you all know. But what's interesting here again is Oberon, when Oberon tells Puck about what he's going to do, he does spend a lot of time creating this narrative context, right? So Oberon says, Thou rememberest, since once I sat upon a promontory and heard a mermaid on a dolphin's back uttering such dulcet and harmonious breath that the rude sea grew civil at her song. That might be important for us because we're going to look at The Tempest, which is a play that begins with the rude sea, not civil at all. And in fact, not many people are civil at the beginning of The Tempest. And certain stars shot madly from their spheres to hear the sea maid's music. So again, a total cosmic context, a total cosmic narrative. And that's when Puck says, I remember. And why did Shakespeare put that there? It's a throwaway line, I remember. You could just carry, why can't Oberon just carry on? He doesn't carry on. It's important for us to see that Puck remembers. And as he remembers, the thing gradually takes on more and more reality for him until he's able to say to Oberon, right, I know what you're talking about, and I'm going to go and do it, even though he completely messes it up. But that will be for another time. So, we've got this sense of narrative and its connection to the being of the imagination, remembering stories. When the lovers awake from what they take to be a dream, human reality and imagination stand for a moment in their own words, and I do believe you have those words, undistinguishable. Is that what I've got? Yes, these things seem small and undistinguishable, like far-off mountains turned to clouds. And Hermia says, methinks I see things with a parted eye, where everything seems double. And Helena echoes this by saying that she has now found her love Demetrius like a jewel, mine own and not mine own. Now, their vision is transfigured so together, as Hippolyta will later say. And that vision quickly fades, of course, as the lovers rejoin the human world. But in that moment, in a way, that Demetrius line is so enticing and wonderfully charming, because the things that seem small and undistinguishable are far off mountains turned into clouds. You don't know where one ends and the other begins. You don't know where the solidity melts into dream. What seems certain, sure, and empirically demonstrable is somehow also linked to what seems cloudy and dreamlike and not really there. So with that in mind, with this idea of our own and not our own, this idea of a double sight, far off mountain turning clouds, or the seeing with a parted eye, I'm using that to think about the theatre a little bit. Because in a way, when we do look at when we are in the theatre, we do see things with a parted eye. We see things that are once there and not there, things that are our own and not our own. So I'm taking theatre here to mean a kind of threshold between the world of story, of poetry, of memory, of imagination, and the world of reason, time, causality, becoming, and of what is possible in the sense of reasonable, in terms of what the human reason can understand. So this seeing with a parted eye, a moment when reality is at once itself and more than itself, our own and not our own, becomes essential for how Shakespeare explores and articulates the mysterious yet eminently human occurrence of forgiveness in his later plays. So I'm reminded about this quote, I think it's Maynard Mack who talks about this continuum, that audiences in a theatre have this continuum between engagement and detachment. So it is actually, if you think about it, it is quite miraculous what happens in the theatre. How can we do this thing that we know it's play, we know it's make-believe, and yet we are intensely caught with it? And I like this idea of the continuum. You don't know where one ends and the other begins. And if it weren't the case, theatre would be utterly unintelligible. So it's only because things are present and absent that the intelligibility of theatre and of story somehow works. So, the things we picked up from our little excursion in the woods outside of Athens are the importance of story, of remembering story, story as a vital component of the world of memory and imagination. And therefore, remembering the right story is somehow acknowledging being. Right? This is the feature of the imagination world. We've also touched on the insufficiency of human reason as a mode of dramatic resolution. And finally, the theatrical as something that is both itself and not itself. So I'm going to break down, I'm going to talk about five moments, and now we're finally touching on The Tempest, five moments in The Tempest where these things are kind of crucial. And Shakespeare uses these features in that to do the work of forgiveness and transform the reality of the play. Now, there's a common, I think, take on The Tempest, which portrays Prospero as a kind of benevolent Renaissance magus who has the right plan in his head all along, and because he keeps telling us that, actually, if you remember the play, he's constantly telling us, I know exactly what I'm doing, this is what I'm doing, this is next, everything that's happening is exactly according to my plan. That sounds like the evil emperor in Star Wars, but this is really kind of weird. But I think one thing we can learn from Shakespeare is when characters have this kind of declaratory manner of saying, I'm doing this, I'm in charge, I'm in control, we know that somewhere along the line in the play, the opposite is going to become true. I think for Prospero, that is the case. He may be a very, very powerful magus. He may be able to command the elements. But the one thing needful in the play, which he himself finds hard to do and doesn't in fact do until Act 5, is forgive. So there is still an action that magic, human technology, however great, cannot accomplish just by itself. So in the following, I suppose I should just acknowledge the work of Northrop Frye and Sarah Beckwith. Their writing on The Tempest have very much influenced what I'm about to share with you. So if you remember, the play really begins with a society, if you will, that is certainly on its way down, or even drowning. And of course, on the boat that is drowning, that is lost in the tempest, we have Alonso, the king of Naples. We've got Antonio, who is Prospero's usurping brother, who has usurped his power in Milan by working with Alonso, the king of Naples, and according to their plan, sending Prospero and his daughter Miranda to their death. I'm just kind of giving you a brief synopsis here. Other characters on the boat, Sebastian, Alonso's brother, and the good counselor Gonzalo, and of course, Alonso's son, Ferdinand, and a whole host of other important people. But you know, they're drowning, and it's easy for us to pick up, okay, this is drama. This is something, something needs to change here. There's a kind of society that is sick. But I think in the very next scene, we encounter the society on the island. And if you remember, we've got Prospero, Caliban, Ariel, the spirit, and Miranda. They all appear in the very, very next scene. But all is not well in that society either, because Prospero is at odds with pretty much everyone. He's at odds with Miranda, who's not listening to him, or at least he thinks so. He's at odds with Ariel, who longs to be freed and keeps saying, well, you know, you promised, when are you going to free me? He's at odds with Caliban, who also wants to be free, according to his own definition of what freedom is. Ariel and Caliban are at odds. Miranda and Caliban are at odds. So all is not well. So there's a kind of mirror image between the two societies. Nonetheless, we get this sense from the language. This is what we're going to be looking at quite a lot, is the language. That Prospero is a man whose hour has come, right? His time is now. And he is emotive. And all throughout the play, he has this, he has sort of imperative language. He commands, he demands, he requires, he swears, he requests. He's constantly sort of charging characters to do things and elements to do things, and fully in control, or so he thinks. But also because all the other characters seem to be slipping out of his grasp a little bit. So, for example, that little passage that I've got there for you, that's it's got that little title that says "The Memory" in brackets, if you've got that. I'm doing a little bit of language analysis for those of you who are remembering the heady days of A-level English. So we've got Prospero saying, "The hour's now come, the very minute bids thee ope thine ear, obey and be attentive." So he's addressing Miranda, of course. "Canst thou remember a time before we came unto this cell? I do not think thou canst, for then thou wast not out 3 years old." And what I like here is that he doesn't wait for Miranda's response. He's already interrupting her, right? "Canst thou remember a time before we came unto the cell? Actually, I do not think," right? So he's very much he wants to be in control of what is going to happen next. And Miranda confounds his expectations. She says, "Certainly, sir, I can." Right? So Prospero doesn't have this right. Now he's surprised here in his next intervention. "By what? By any other house or person? Of anything that image tell me that hath kept with thy remembrance." So Miranda says, "'Tis far off, and rather like a dream than an assurance that my remembrance warrants." I want to point out to you this doubleness of memory here, right? Rather like a dream. We remember Midsummer Night's Dream and its dream world, the imagination, than an assurance. Assurance is a reason term, isn't it? I mean, to speak crudely, certainly post-Cartesian philosophers are very much concerned with certainty and assurance. They want to know what's what. Yes, so there's a kind of rational need for assurance juxtaposed with this memory that seems like a dream. So let's remember these two kinds of memory, because they're already at play early on in this play, and they're going to continue being at play. So she's in this dream mode. She says, "Had I not 4 or 5 women once that tended me? Thou hadst, and more, Miranda." I'm exaggerating his kind of imperative language, but this is to illustrate how he is anxious to correct the story, right? He's anxious to say, this is what, you know, this is what we think and what we believe. This is what happened and what will happen. Yeah, so controlling. But he's still interested in Miranda. "How is it that this lives in thy mind? What seest thou else in the dark backward and abysm of time?" Another line I want to think about for a second. The dark backward and abysm of time. He's using backward as a noun. He's calling the past the backward. Not just the backward, the dark backward. Right? And the abysm of time. There's a sense of this darkness and this abyss. The past feels like a dark place. right? And it's something that is receding in this abyss backward. So, of course it does, because Prospero's past is painful. He's been wronged. And this memory of this wrong, he's carrying with him to this day. So it's very interesting that Shakespeare gives him this dark line, this dark way of thinking about the past. So, nonetheless, if thou rememberest aught ere thou camest here, how thou camest here thou mayest. I never cease to wonder how difficult that line is to say. It's quite interesting. It certainly bespeaks his emotion. Miranda says, but that I do not. So the dream memory sort of fades away. So we've got these two kinds of memory and Prospero's insistent demands to remember things correctly. And these demands and the rest of the scene are also made to Ariel, who wishes to be freed, and Caliban, who also wishes to be freed. In each case, Prospero's language is harsh, imperative, commanding, distressed. Has Prospero substituted himself through his desire for justice and perhaps even for some kind of revenge, rather than just the master of magic, also the master of everyone else's memory? Why is memory so important anyway? So what does it mean to remember? So as I'm illustrating, there's a doubleness to things, right? There's a world of the imagination and a world of reason, and there's a dream memory and an assurance memory. So we can think of this doubleness in terms of perhaps using a sort of geometric analogy, a vertical memory and a horizontal one. The horizontal one bound to the world of becoming and causality and time, and therefore the dark backward and abysm of time. And a vertical memory, and I'm speaking here about a very august history of memory, both in philosophy and in theology, and certainly the philosophical tradition I'm familiar with, which is Plato, and the Platonic tradition. And possibly the Platonic tradition has a different reading of what anamnesis means than Plato does, but that'll be for another time. And certainly theologically, we're talking today about wonderful chapters in the Confessions. So we've got the Augustinian tradition, we've got the Platonic tradition. And so memory is a big thing. And what it isn't, what it certainly isn't, is of course what we imagine memory to be, which is what we were saying before, computer memory, or a data bank. I think that notion is certainly alien to Shakespeare, and is certainly a post-17th century kind of notion. So these two memories, the vertical memory and the horizontal memory, and slipping into a bit of a Platonic flavor, we've got the remembering what was in the horizontal sense, and in the vertical sense, we've got the remembering what always is, remembering a kind of knowledge that has always been so. A knowledge that is or shows kinship and likeness amongst the things that are, rather than pain and conflict amongst the things that were. So in this vertical sense, we remember because things are already remembered, if you will, in a kind of elusive primordial kinship. So kinship knowledge is also self-knowledge, because we know ourselves not merely simply as ourselves, as isolated individuals, but through our relationships with all other things and all other selves. But this different kind of memory, remembering kinship and likeness, is when reality in which things seem different and unrelated becomes translucent and a greater likeness shines through, rather like, if you will, a metaphoric process, a metaphor which, despite the tension between two images or two ideas, nonetheless shows a kind of greater likeness. It doesn't necessarily collapse the unlikeness. It keeps the tension. But this is somehow a greater likeness shining through. And that's the idea that I want to tease out with the relationship between the two kinds of memories. So Prospero is not only interested in Miranda's memory, but also what she sees. And at this point, he has sent Ariel to play some heavenly music, and Ferdinand, who has survived the tempest, just like all the other nobles have survived, but they don't know that each other have survived, of course. Ferdinand is being led by the music to Prospero's cell. And Prospero is, rather like a theatre director, is kind of engineering a nice little bit of theatre. And as Ferdinand is approaching the cell, he says to Miranda, "The fringed curtains of thine eye..." You've got this, by the way. Sorry, I keep sort of slipping in and out of my poetic nature. But you've got that bit. So this is passage one. "The fringed curtains of thine eye advance and say what thou seest yond." Say what thou seest yond. He wants to hear what she says. He wants to hear how she responds. Miranda says, "What is it? A spirit? Lord, how it looks about. Believe me, sir, it carries a brave form, but 'tis a spirit." And of course she says it's a spirit. She's more at home in the dream world than she is in the sort of human world. So it's natural for her to say that. And Prospero, again, correcting her, "No, wench, it eats and sleeps and hath such senses as we have, such." But Miranda persists in the dream manner and says, "I might call him a thing divine, for nothing natural I ever saw so noble." And Prospero's response is interesting. "It goes on, I see, as my soul prompts it." It's a kind of wonderfully theatrical word there, the prompting, which is going to return several times. Now, Miranda has called him a spirit. What does Ferdinand say? He says, "Most sure, the goddess on whom these heirs attend." So he's also calling her something rather special. I'm skipping quite a few lines here, but he says, my prime request, which I do last pronounce, is, "Oh, you wonder if you be made or no." And Miranda says, "No wonder, sir, but certainly a maid." Of course, we know that the word Miranda means wonder. So what's beautiful here is that Ferdinand has named her what she is, right? She's calling her, he is calling her by her name, but also somehow by something in her being, some kind of quality that he's lighting on. And wonder is connected to this seeing things with a parted eye, our own and not our own, of A Midsummer Night's Dream. But I'll come back to that. So this beautiful, "Oh, your spirit, goddess, wonder." So this is love language, isn't it? And we know, we 21st century post-critical, post-structural, post-everything cynical beings that we are, when we hear all this love language, we think, "Ah, oh, this is just Renaissance, you know, sort of commonplace. Get on with the play." But actually, the love language and the grammar of the love language is very, very important. And we need to attend to it with innocence, because otherwise we won't catch the heart of the play of what's really going on. So let's note the spirit goddess wonder thing. It's important. And Prospero doesn't note it, right? His aside is, "Oh, the Duke of Milan and his more braver daughter could control thee." He's still in that control mode. "If now 'twere fit to do it." At the first sight, he says, "they have changed eyes." I think that's a great way of telling us what wonder is. At the first sight, they have changed eyes. Now, a lot of people gloss this as they've exchanged glances, which makes the line a little bit tautological. At the first sight, they've had a first glance. That doesn't quite square. I prefer to think about the first sight, not just in the sense of their first sight in the world of time, of becoming the horizontal world, if you will, but the first sight. Right? And if you think about the first sight, it's God's sight. The first thing that we hear in Genesis is that God sees things and says that they are good. That's the first sight. So there's a resonance that goes all the way to that first sight, if you will. And that first sight is in the vertical plane, not the horizontal one. And I'm reminded of a wonderful moment in Dostoevsky, who is full of wonderful moments, moments full of wonder. To love someone is to see them as God intended them. right? That beautiful, that's right there. So this is a wonderful way of telling us what wonder is. And of course, it is someone who's not wondering. Shakespeare often does that. He has, in the mouth of someone who is not quite believing what they're saying, he has these wonderful evocative poetic lines. So, we've had these two kinds of memories. The other thing that we picked up from A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I hope you're all with me, you're all following, is the sense of the insufficiency of reason. And that appears in the play too, a couple of scenes down the line. I'm skipping a lot of really important scenes and really important speeches. I'm doing that on purpose, so bear with me. If you remember, there is a good counselor on that bad ship. There's the good Gonzalo, friend of Prospero, who saved Prospero and Miranda. And he's interesting because his sight is also different to all the others. He's walking around the island, and what he sees, we've got Antonio and Sebastian who are making all these cynical remarks, and Alonso is in some kind of despair because the poor guy thinks he's lost his son. But Gonzalo sort of thinks this island's wonderful. He sees things. In a manner which sort of bespeaks his character a little bit. So he too has this sense, a kind of sense of the first sight, but it is, I want to suggest, a first sight has become a bit dimmed. Not dim, but dimmed. So we've got that extract as well. It's, we've got this little bit in brackets that says the reason. And this is a speech that is meant to have been lifted pretty much verbatim from Montaigne. And I really, dramatically speaking, it doesn't have much purpose. And I'm always fascinated to look at a Shakespearean speech. If it has no purpose dramatically, it must have some other purpose, right? So it's very interesting to think about that. And if we attend to it for a second, he talks about this ideal utopian commonwealth that he evokes. And this is from being in the island. And so it reminds him of this thought. In the commonwealth I would by contraries execute all things. For no kind of traffic would I admit, no name of magistrate, letters should not be known, riches, poverty, and use of service none, contract, succession, born, bound of land, tilth, vineyard, none, no use of metal, corn, or wine, or oil, no occupation, all men idle, all. Sounds rather like the academic world. And women too, but innocent and pure. No sovereignty. All things in common nature should produce without sweat or endeavor. Treason, felony, sword, pike, knife, gun, or need of any engine would I not have, but nature should bring forth of its own kind all poison, all abundance, to feed my innocent people. Almost like the Labour manifesto these days. But this is interesting. I mean, it sounds good at some level, but what's peculiar about his kind of language is there's very little that affirms anything. Right? We've had the language of lovers who call each other all these wonderful, marvellous, divine, quasi-divine things. But Gonzalo's speech is a speech that is marked by negativity, in the sense of he's telling us what there isn't and not so much of what there is. In fact, I don't know what the human beings in that commonwealth do. They don't seem to do anything at all. So this negative language resonates with and reflects the sound, the language of reason. Since reason distinguishes, reason excludes, and reason divides what only love can embrace. So without some kind of action of love, utopia only and ever appears in a negative form as something which is not this, not that. But a society built on no cannot have forgiveness as or love as founding principles, since in some sense it is founded on an idea of exclusion, however noble the exclusion. So to put it another way, a society of love and forgiveness is not thinkable by the rational faculty, which dissects and separates, but perhaps in another way. What I'm saying here is what we've seen again in the Midsummer Night's Dream. Reason excludes contradiction. Love embraces them. And we see this in the very next little bit that I want to think about. So when we come to the second little moment of theatre, which you've got on your sheet there as well. When we come to that second vision, some rules are being broken, because Prospero said he's playing the Senex Eratus. You know, he's saying, a bit like Aegeus in Midsummer Night's Dream, you can't speak to my daughter. And he says to Miranda, you're not allowed to come near Ferdinand and don't tell him your real name. And so, but we know, we the audience, we know that he's playing around. He's making this whole thing happen. So, but there is a kind of quality in this language that is exactly the opposite to Gonzalo's utterances about the utopian society. And if we look at this, it's this little extract here, number two. It's sort of dense and poetically charged and hyperbolic, right? So Miranda says, do you love me? Always a terrible question. Ferdinand, oh heaven, oh earth, bear witness to this sound and crown what I profess with kind event, if I speak true. So he's vowing, swearing, if hollowly, invert what best is boded me to mischief. Now he's possibly cursing himself. Beyond all limits of what else in the world, I beyond all limits of what else in the world do love, prize, honor you. So there is a bit of negativity here because it's beyond all limits. But at the same time, it is a negativity that is affirmed. I do love, prize, honor you. Miranda, I am a fool to weep at what I'm glad of. So these wonderful juxtapositions, these sort of coincidence of opposites that are so dear to so many Renaissance writers, right? Ferdinand, wherefore weep you? Miranda, at mine unworthiness that dare not offer what I desire to give, and much less take what I shall die to want. So all these opposites are being reconciled here, yes? But this is trifling, she says, and all the more it seeks to hide itself, the bigger bulk it shows. Hence bashful cunning, so we get rid of all this cleverness, and prompt me plain and holy innocence. So she's asking innocence to give her the language, prompt me, as in a kind of theatrical way. I am your wife, so there's this affirming here, if you will marry me, conditional, if not, I'll die your maid. So another more vowing and cursing and swearing. To be your fellow, you may deny me, but I'll be your servant, whether you will or no. So this is this kind of incredible hyperbolic grammar that takes in all kinds of shades, all kinds of opposites, all kinds of this and that, but not this, but also that. And I vow this, but I also vow that, right? So all these incredible energies that seem to contradict each other are somehow embraced in this hyperbolic speech, which to us might sound like two people, the foolishness of youth. And so somehow the language of love has this unreasonable sound about it. But from love's point of view, this is normal language, and our language is the unreasonable one. So Ferdinand and Miranda, having exchanged eyes at the first sight, now speak this particular story to each other by speaking this particular grammar. The language of love is the language that speaks the impossible and makes it possible. So we've had the negative grammar of Gonzalo, we've had the imperative grammar of Prospero, and even though I'm not looking at it today, we also have this sort of jocular and bawdy but somehow dangerous grammar of Caliban and Trinculo and Stefano. But that will unfortunately have to be for another time. Maybe the questions, if we have time for that. So, but here, so we're back to this idea of responding, being addressed and saying what we see. At the beginning, at the extract before, Prospero had put Miranda in a position to say what she sees and what she feels. Now we're hearing Shakespeare is almost putting on this little show because he's interested in hearing what Prospero says about it or to it. And his response is interesting, which you've got there as well. So glad of this as they, I cannot be, who are surprised with all. But my rejoicing at nothing can be more. So surprise and wonder are not for him. He's happy, but not, I can't be as glad as this. And instead he falls back into his other manner of speech, which is very sort of action-centered. All to my book, for yet at supper time must I perform much business obtain, right? So this is his sound. So our next bit, we're coming to the when forgiveness really enters the play, it comes in quite late. So you'll have to bear with me a little longer. The third moment of theatre is more spectacular than poetics. It's less to do with words. But it is that famous scene. If you remember, Prospero sends Ariel to set up this banquet, this sort of imaginative or imaginary banquet, which turns into a kind of demonic scene. I don't know if you remember that. So as Alonso and Antonio and Sebastian approach to eat the food, suddenly everything changes from an idyllic thing into a demonic thing. So this vision is set up by Ariel and Prospero, but also is emanating from Alonso, Antonio, and Sebastian's own memories, right? Because as the vision changes from the idyllic to the demonic thing, they begin to remember some of the things that have happened. And we've got Ariel's kind of prose here. I think you've got it. It's number 3. But remember, Ariel says to that little group, for that's my business to you, that you three from Milan did supplant good Prospero, exposed unto the sea which hath requited him and his innocent child, for which foul deed the powers delaying, not forgetting, have incensed the seas and shores, yea, all the creatures against your peace. So there's a sort of demonic voice here. The stories that come, that are in the past, in the dark, backward, and abysm of time, the dark stories, and that are unacknowledged, are not forgotten, right? So delaying, not forgetting. And if you think about Shakespearean tragedy, this often happens. This is true in Shakespearean tragedy, where for a very long time, sometimes in a Shakespearean tragedy, the villain seems to be getting away with it. But the cosmos has been groaning, right? And so we know that the world is not happy, and at some point the villain is, as it were, caught up with, more or less. Or there's, of course, the recognition scene of the tragic hero, that, you know, suddenly there's sort of anagnorisis, where the hero recognizes what he's done or what has happened. And at the end of this little moment of theatre, there is that, because the king is in utter despair, right? Not only has he lost his son, but also he has sort of acknowledge to some extent what he has done. Antonio and Sebastian are unrepentant, and Gonzalo doesn't really seem to have seen anything, which is quite interesting. So the two kinds of memories, we've had them: the memory that evokes wonder, that is of the belongs to the plane of love, and the memory of past wrongs, which can be perhaps remedied by acknowledgement and perhaps by repentance. So in the very next, so I'm skipping along quite a bit, but we think about when finally Ariel gives Prospero the story or the narrative of what she has seen. She prompts Prospero with an interesting response. So we've got that little bit of narrative from Ariel, which is under your number 4. The king, his brother, and yours abide all three distracted, and the remainder mourning over them, brimful of sorrow and dismay. But chiefly him that you termed, sir, the good old Lord Gonzalo. His tears run down his beard, so he has seen something, like winter's drops from eaves of reeds. Your charm so strongly works him that if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender. So Ariel's here prompting Prospero by telling Prospero a story. Ariel is not a human character. She's acting as a prompt. And Prospero turns to Ariel and says, dost thou think so, spirit? No longer commanding, no longer controlling the story, but listening to a story. Ariel says, mine would, sir, were I human and Prospero, and mine shall. And that's an interesting shall, because it is a shall of a commanding kind. But the shall that is commanded here is forgiveness. So even though, so there's another kind of juxtaposition here, because love, of course, can't be commanded, and yet it is the eminent commandment. But it switches, that mind shall switches into a wonderful human question, right? So he meditates on this in the form of a question. Hast thou, which are but air, a touch, a feeling of their affliction, and shall not myself, he's almost beholding himself at a distance here, one of their kind, that relish all as sharply, passion as they, be kindlier moved than thou art? So has thou, so again, these things from the sort of more than human world of the imagination are there but are not there, our own and not our own, right? Because we're often told, aren't we, in The Tempest, oh, we are such stuff as dreams are made on, you know, Puck in the Midsummer Night's Dream is constantly telling us, we're not really here, it's a dream. Everything is not what it seems. And yet, here Prospero is saying, this prompt, you are but air, right? And is this prompt from the sort of more than human world, is that what is moving me to be truly human? He asks and not really answers, right? There's this wonderful question that opens this whole realm for us here. So, we have got this intervention of the superhuman. And just to lock that down a little bit more, there's a wonderful causelessness about the intervention of the superhuman, of the more than human, in human affairs. And of course, the causeless is ultimately, this is really my big suggestion to you here, is ultimately what moves and what resolves drama. It's something of the nature of something gratuitous, causeless, spontaneous, right? It's not Prospero moving into a kind of Kantian sense of duty, say, right, I'm going to forgive. Right? There's a continuum between our own and not our own, here and not here, the human and the world and the more than human. And Shakespeare doesn't settle that for us, because he wants us to stay with that mysterious participation. So we've come to the final vision, the final little bit of theatre that I want to draw your attention to. And that's really at the very end, when all the characters are together, and this is after words of acknowledgement and repentance and reconciliation that have been exchanged in the play. And this is really a proper moment of theatre, because Prospero, you know, he almost sort of lifts the curtain, and finally we see together Miranda and Ferdinand gently playing chess and sort of having this lovely sort of lovers banter, as the kids say, right? Sort of back and forth in this delightful way. And of course, here's Ferdinand, he's come back from the dead. And here's his father Alonso, he's come back from the dead. So all the characters, all those that were dead to each other, are now alive to each other. And it's complete theatre, because they're all reacting to each other in the form of a kind of, they're all the audience and all the characters. That's just quite wonderful. But the response that I want to draw your attention to is Miranda's response, because she stands up and she sees this scene of old men, I think, who've done many wrongs in their life. But she sees with that first sight, and she says, speaking her name, oh wonder, how many goodly creatures are there here, how beauteous mankind is, oh brave new world that has such people in it. Post Aldous Huxley, we can't take that line seriously. But that's because we've had 4 centuries of plot spoilers. But imagine, this is a beautiful response from a character who's so, by speaking in that way, in that wandering way, she is speaking Miranda, she's speaking her being. And Prospero's response, I think, is tender. 'Tis new to thee. It's not this dismissive imperative sound that we had at the beginning of the play. It is Prospero transformed by the actions of forgiveness. And he wonders at her. He wonders at her wondering. From the standpoint of his life and his old age and all the things that have happened in the dark, backward abyss of time, he nonetheless has a moment where he is surprised. Finally, it's taken us 5 acts to get there. So we have Alonso who looks at... Of course, Ferdinand and Miranda are married, so Alonso is, you know, technically Miranda is his child. And Alonso says... But oh, how oddly will it sound that I must ask my child forgiveness. And Prospero says, there, sir, stop. Let us not burden our remembrance with a heaviness that's gone. And I think that's the key here, because forgiveness is a totally different relationship to the past rather than an erasing of the past. Right? So the heaviness is gone. The story remains, but the heaviness is gone. The relationship, the quality of the relationship has been raised from that imperative, emotive language of the beginning to a sense of wonder and surprise that the whole, in some way, all the characters share. So here we have this sort of elusive grammar and poetry of forgiveness, which plays and sort of hovers about the play without fully sort of a being the major, fulfilling a major dramatic role, but it nonetheless is eminently there in the quality of the poetry. So, to conclude, I mean, Sebastian and Antonio seem a little bit oddly in the wrong key. And I fully concur with Northrop Frye's brilliant observation because he says that Antonio, when he sees Caliban, calls him a plain fish. And that suggests that he is underwater. He has drowned with the ship and Prospero's books. While all the others seem to be now in a different reality. But that doesn't matter, I think, for Shakespeare, because the nature of forgiveness is, of course, not that of an equal exchange. You know, as Aquinas says, grace, inasmuch as it is given gratuitously, excludes the notion of debt. So... oftentimes, we've got forgiveness scenes in Shakespeare that are very, very quick and strike us as being on the edge of injustice. But it's not justice that Shakespeare is concerned with. It's forgiveness per se. So, as I've said, I think right from the beginning, I think Shakespeare's concern is somehow dramatically to make possible the impossible, to shine the light of forgiveness, the light of the eternal memory and of the more than human world represented by dream, spirit, imagination, entering through the threshold of theatre into the dark, backward, and abysm of time, the realm of change, of sorrow, of hurt, and ultimately of death. This is only possible if the two realms are seen together, one intertwined in the other, one made perhaps translucent for the other. And thus also each realm gains its own uniqueness. This is the wonder of the theatre itself. If it is a mirror, it's a mirror that is at once opaque and transparent, at once here and not here, at once our own and not our own, itself and more than itself, like humans moved by forgiveness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a great, a lot of wonder in me of remembering back to GCSE English, not A-level. But it's a really, really wonderful talk.
Thank you.
I think I've got a lot of thoughts and comments, but I'll open up to the audience first. I'll let you go on for a bit longer, so we don't have a huge amount of time. I do want to finish at 9 so that people can go if they need to and continue discussions. But the first question is here, if it's all right, I'll share.
Thanks very much for the talk, appreciate it. As you were talking, I was thinking about a line from Much Ado, but wonder on and let us to the chapel presently, comes at the very end. And it made me think about the sort of ecclesiastical centering of Shakespeare's earlier plays versus what happens in the later plays. Mm. You frame this very much as art and theater, what theater does. Yes. Do you see theater in the later plays supplanting the sort of what what the church can and must do? Or do you see what the church can and must do as being sort of transposed into the language and of theater and drama?
Well, the latter, definitely. That's a great question. I think Shakespeare, I mean, I'm now speculating, but I think Shakespeare, as he matures, becomes increasing. I think the theological questions become ever more internalized. I think he's concerned with not having characters talk theologically, but instead embody concerns which are ultimately religious and theological. And I feel that he's very interested in developing that. So that the dramatic happenings on stage must also look and feel and sound eminently human, and yet more than. So there's this kind of curious dichotomy. But I don't think he sees the theatre as supplanting it. On the contrary, he uses his art in a very cosmic way to explore all these questions. That answers your question.
Thank you so much, Valentine. My question has to do with forgiveness. And if I could ask you to not speak for Shakespeare, but perhaps to imagine with him for a minute. You talked about how forgiveness isn't necessarily, well, it certainly isn't something that can be sort of technologically produced.
Yeah.
And it's also not something that you can reason yourself toward. But I'm thinking about times in my life when I really wanted to do something to help myself forgive.
Yeah.
Or to be forgiven. And I'm thinking of hard conversations with friends who really need to forgive. And what might Shakespeare say to a person who cannot? Is there anything that can be done besides wait for that grace? And the backdrop to this question is, actually with a lot of different friends in a lot of different contexts, we've been looking at forgiveness in different languages, like Latin, for instance, and finding that there doesn't exist in Latin an abstract noun, as far as I know, for forgiveness, even something like the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. It sounds very different in Latin.
Yes.
With the backdrop that there are cultures in which forgiveness seems to be a duty. You must forgive. Or a virtue, like courage, something that you could be, something that you could choose. What would Shakespeare say to someone like me who might come to him and say, I really want to forgive, I can't, what might I do?
Well, first of all, you're asking me to speak on Shakespeare's behalf. I often talk to Shakespeare, and he usually tells me to mind my own business. The quality that I've got my finger on in a hesitatingly, and this may be because of my own philosophical and theological sympathies, I don't know, but I think I think this is why I try to bring wonder into it, because I think wonder, seeing with the eyes of wonder, is a sort of orientation to forgiveness. It's an orientation to love. It's a sort of turning of one's being towards something which must remain beyond one's being. But it's a very tricky territory, isn't it? Because it's an action that is not an action. I think Shakespeare doesn't solve that. I think his characters tell us how they are oriented towards things, but it's never fully clear why. I think Shakespeare's being very... He doesn't want us to... He's not a moralistic writer. He doesn't want to give us an ethical version of this is what happens when you do this sort of thing. There's that slippery mystery, and that participation of the human with the superhuman, or the known with the unknown, or however you want to put it. And I think he wants us to dwell there and wonder at it. But I mean, speaking personally, this is the understatement of the year, but forgiveness isn't easy. But I do feel that there is, one's heart can be oriented to it. And I may hazard that I have actually learned that from Shakespeare. So that would be my response.
I have a related question, and I tremble at identifying myself as a would-be moral philosopher, I guess.
Right.
yeah, you might want to run, I guess. But it's interesting because I've encountered this idea of justice and forgiveness and how they relate in writings a few different places. My advisor here, but also philosopher like Nicholas Wolterstorff and others,
right, yeah,
who are actually really interested in exploring it, because then we might take seriously the notion that when Christianity enters, when the reality, this more than human reality enters the human reality, then things like justice actually get transformed in a meaningful sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was brought up to think of forgiveness almost as a very unilateral choice type thing.
Yes.
But really, if you look biblically, and if you look here in The Tempest, it's very much a mutuality. There's something going on between and relationally,
yeah,
between people, and it has to involve. I'm not saying there's not a unilateral aspect of forgiveness. There's not. There is a moment of compassion and being moved, like Prospero is. But there's also this remorse and repentance.
Mm.
And yeah, I've thought about this in relation to justice. If you limit yourself to thinking of justice as a sort of reciprocity of tit for tat, he did this to me, so I'll do this to them, and that's somehow satisfying.
Mm.
The real human reality is there's nothing really satisfying about that. What is satisfying is that sort of moved by compassion.
Yes.
You seeing the suffering of others, reminding you of your suffering, but then the lucid remorse.
Mm.
And that's a satisfying response to someone who's been wrong, in a way that retaliation is never satisfying. And so justice is actually, I would argue, is embodied in forgiveness in a way that it can never be embodied without forgiveness.
Wow.
Now, it has to include remorse. It has to include the mutuality aspect, but it really is justice in a truer sense. Mm. I would like to make that argument, but then I would also want to be careful not to be reductive and say it's just something you can achieve with human reason. You know? Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And I think the relation, it's not like we have three tiers of reality. This is justice right here, and you've got revenge down here, forgiveness up here. I mean, I do see that sort of, because justice is, of course, a reestablishment of harmony, isn't it, to some extent? I mean, that's what's being called on. There's so much in what you said. And one thing that I might would love to add to that is that I think lucid remorse in some mysterious way has to entail an element of forgiveness, of not just merely acknowledging that I have done wrong, but a new kind of relationships with the wrongs that I have done. So even remorse itself has a kind of forgiveness kind of quality to it. So forgiveness trickles into even remorse, or must, in order for justice to be done, I think it must somehow trickle into it. So dynamically, we can think about the two in a dynamic sort of relationship, I guess. And I really don't want to say, you know, this is how the metaphysical kind of thing works out. But what a wonderful searching question. Thank you.
Any more questions? I'm sort of intrigued by your using the fact that this is also a play. There's like another sort of thing going on here with Shakespeare writing this as a play. Mm. And like you say, a play demands like a response. Mm. I don't know. You've acted Shakespeare from what I know.
For my sins, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, I don't know, I'm just intrigued by that idea, and do you think that there is, I don't know, there is that connection with the audience and the play in the way that Shakespeare is often done today? I don't know, I guess there is. I'm trying to think of theatre plays of Shakespeare that I've seen.
Wow.
And like that sort of breaking down of the fourth wall or whatever it is.
Right.
It's my drama GCSE coming up. Sort of, you know, is that something that you're also more curious about? Because that's what really caught, that was part of your talk that really intrigued me about this connection between the unreal on the stage and the real of the audience. And
Yeah, and I think, you know, a play, the wonderful thing about a play is that it allows us to play in the sense that there is this element of what if this were so, that for some reason we are able to enter in a very, very deep way. I mean, we feel, don't we? I mean, you know, tragedy, the profundity. I've wept a tear or two in my time in the theater, you know. So there's a kind of very serious human thing happening there. But at the same time, it's got that sort of playful dimension. And I suppose I've been saying that a lot tonight, but that those two worlds are not easily definable as separate. Mm. And so I think Shakespeare is naturally, as a gifted artist, just aware that this is what theater does, and he likes to set it up in all kinds of ways. I mean, he's playing with us. He's playing with our response to things, and he's even sometimes perhaps manipulating our responses to things a bit, you know, setting something up, and we like this character, and all of a sudden, oh, well, we don't like him anymore, and we like that character. So he's doing that, but he's also, I hope that's what came through tonight, but he's also doing that to his own characters, I think, ultimately. That they must see something presented in front of them and respond, and that response is somehow eminently important. I don't know if that addressed your question at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, no, but... yeah, a little bit. Yeah, no. I think
okay, maybe
just,
I didn't quite.
It's just something I found interesting. Mm. Yeah.
Can I sort of jump on that?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you want to say anything about the epilogue, where Prospero at the end of the play asks the audience for applause.
Yes.
In this. Verse in which includes, if I remember, an echo of the Lord's Prayer.
Yes.
As you from crimes would pardon me, let your indulgence set me free.
Yes.
And it seems to me this is kind of a turning the tables on the audience.
Yeah, so right.
I forget.
Very good.
Now, what about you?
Yeah, very good.
And
yeah.
It really, he's coming out of character and, you know, halfway out of
yeah.
character. And really, I like what you say about the playfulness in the play. This epilogue isn't very playful.
Yeah,
it's, you know,
yeah. There's a kind of sting to it in a way. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I left that out. I mean, kind of on purpose. But I'm glad you. I mean, that's absolutely brilliantly observed. I can't add anything to that. That's very good.
Yeah, I think it's been a great talk. Thank you very
thank
much
you very much
for coming and sharing with us. It fitted in well with our talk on justice by Bethan Willis.
Great.
She was saying exactly the same thing. Justice is this linking between not just a calculating measurement,
right.
but actually justice is about sort of inverting perspectives and letting people share their things. And I think there's mirrors in that as well. It's funny how within our terms, our talks and the people we arrange for our talks don't seem to be particularly... planned out to bring out one single theme, but so often the themes sort of collide into each other and you begin in a term to explore an issue like justice. So it's been a great addition.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.